I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news. Prospects for $2,000 corona relief checks are dimming in the waning days of the lame duck Congress, and President Trump makes an early return to the White House from Florida today. Let's check in with Axios Politics and White House editor Margaret Tolove. Hey, Margaret.
Hey, great to be with you. Happy New Year's.
Happy New Year to you. Well, let's start with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Here's what he said yesterday about this.
The Senate's not going to be bullied into rushing out more borrowed money into the hands of Democrat rich friends who don't need the help. We just approved almost $1 trillion in aid a few days ago.
Okay, so President Trump demanded $2,000 checks, and Democrats were actually happy to agree with him. What has McConnell's strategy been this week?
McConnell's strategy has been to make sure that they could override the president's veto of the Defense Authorization Act first, postponing any formal decision on this until the end, and then run out of time. He has made clear for weeks, if not months, that he didn't want another $2,000 check or anything like that. The Republicans, the reason they were at $600 before is because the Republicans didn't want to do it. And while McConnell is messaging about Democrats, he's really talking to President Trump. He's setting a line in the sand, and it will cost people who wanted more money their money, but setting a line in the sand that the president can't railroad the Republican Party inside the Senate into completely changing their plans just on a whim. And I think part of this is about what McConnell, you know, wanted in terms of the stimulus checks. And part of this is about the fact that when President Trump moves on to be an ex-president, he's going to try to manage the Republican Party from beyond office. And McConnell is trying to draw a line in the sand and say, nope, this is my Senate, not yours.
Okay, well, the Senate will meet tomorrow to vote on overriding President Trump's veto on a defense policy bill. Do you think there'll be any 11th hour deal then on relief checks or a deal in the next Congress? Republican Senator Lindsey Graham was on Fox News this morning saying he still supports $2,000 checks. So there is Republican support for it.
There is, and there's Republican support for President Trump, too. And I think those are two separate questions. They may overlap in some cases, but not always. You know, there are people who didn't want the $2,000 before and now they're for it. It, based on everything we have seen, it doesn't seem like there would be any final change in the waning days of President Trump's presidency to get to that $2,000 figure. 100% there will be a push in the new Biden administration for another round of stimulus. Where that goes has as much to do with how constituents in Republican districts in the Senate want them to act, as well as what Democrats or a Democratic president want. The clock will start over in the next Congress, and this begins in just a few days. But in terms of the waning days of this Congress and probably the waning days of the Trump administration, under McConnell's leadership, there is no appetite for a last-minute deal that would triple or more the stimulus checks that people are going to get.
Okay, something else we're watching. Early voting in Tuesday's Senate runoff elections in Georgia seem to favor Democratic challengers Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff. Is anyone predicting the outcome at this point?
I mean, if that's true, if the trends continue, it's a stunning reversal of fortune. You know, this is a race. These are two races now bound together that were always supposed to favor Republicans. And yes, Stacey Abrams and the push to register voters in Georgia has made a difference. You know, yes, the presidential election and demographic changes have helped Democrats in Georgia. But nevertheless, if this actually ends up happening, if Democrats are able to take control of both of those seats and flip control of the Senate, it will be overwhelmingly because of President Trump's efforts to delegitimize the legitimate election results and to cast doubt on whether Republicans can trust the electoral and election system.
That's Margaret Tolove. She's politics and White House editor at Axios. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Well, tucked into the spending bill President Trump signed this week were several higher education reform measures aimed at aiding students from marginalized communities as well as historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs. The change expands the Pell Grant program and wipes away federal loans that HBCUs took on for campus improvements. Joining us to break all of this down is Howard University President Wayne A.I. Frederick. And President Frederick, thank you for joining us and Happy New Year.
Thanks for having me. Same to you.
Let's start with this cancellation of HBCU debt. More than 40 colleges and universities currently owe over $1 billion borrowed through a program aimed at financing improvements. Howard University is not part of this program. But what does this cancellation mean for HBCUs as a whole?
It's an important opportunity for HBCUs because as you look at their finances, part of what they obviously build into their programming is obviously paying back this debt. And so canceling that debt means that it can have a very significant impact for the HBCUs who do participate in the program.
Mm-hmm. The free application for federal student aid was also simplified in this bill, removing dozens of questions and making it easier for students to apply for aid. How much of a barrier to higher education was it before this change?
Yeah, you know, that application, commonly known as the FAFSA, was pretty problematic, especially for minority students and low-income students. For instance, I'll give you an example. The form requires that you, for instance, fill out information about both parents. And in some circumstances where, you know, you may be living, I have really grown up with one parent in particular and not as close to another, getting that information, getting the tax information from them was difficult. Mm. That's frustrating. So you have students who may come and try to start school, but their application hasn't been cleared. So you can't even determine what their expected family contribution is. And therefore their aid package, you know, can be formalized. And so it was a significant barrier. And so simplifying that form was also a very, very major move, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. There are also changes to the Pell Grant program, which helps low-income students avoid loans when heading to college. That money doesn't have to be paid back, but experts have criticized how the amount given in Pell Grants is calculated. This new legislation ties it to federal poverty guidelines, so that students know beforehand how much they could potentially get. This change, plus an easier FAFSA form, do you think we'll see a rise in lower-income students pursuing higher education?
You know, I think that will certainly, hopefully, encourage lower-income students, but we still have, a knowledge and information gap. How many of the low-income students actually get that type of information from guidance counselors and others? The amount of unused Pell every year is very significant. And the number of students who apply to college don't fill out or complete a FAFSA and as a result don't go because they simply did not have the information, the encouragement, the guidance is also very significant. And so I still worry that while this is helpful, it may not get to the people that it benefits the most in terms of the information and the education about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry, though? I know that you were saying it's, you know, the bigger problem is the information gap. But do you worry that the amounts of grants won't be enough for, say, if there is an influx of students? Will we see more low-income students stuck with student loan debt that they can't pay back?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. And obviously, as the cost of higher education rises, if the amount of the Pell Grant and the amount of grants that students do not have to pay back in terms of loans, isn't also increased, you're right, more students could end up strapped with loans. But right now, I think the crisis that we have is that high school graduation rates have started to decline. That, as well as a decline in the number of international students that make up the student body and therefore decrease the revenue for all of higher ed, could see a significant pinch on lower income students. So the amount of loans and stuff that we may see them taking over the next 5 years in particular could increase. And so I think it is a definite concern for all of us.
Another significant change to the Pell Grant program is lifting this 26-year-old ban that makes incarcerated people ineligible to receive the grants. What does this access mean for prisoners and their prospects once they're released?
Yeah, you know, recidivism is a very important issue. And as we look at criminal justice reform and getting formerly incarcerated persons back into the society in a way that they can also have gainful employment is critical. And so, again, I see this as a very important step in allowing them to pursue that. There are lots of prison systems now that have higher education components through community colleges and others. And I think it's extremely important that we continue to provide that opportunity. And this Pell Grant access is certainly one way of expanding that. So I think it's extremely important.
Howard University President Wayne A.I. Frederick. President Frederick, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We're learning that Russia's death toll from the pandemic may be three times higher than what's been reported. Health officials say deaths linked to COVID-19, but not listed as the main cause of death, have not been included in the total so far. Adding to them would mean that Russia would have the third highest COVID death toll in the world. Another story we've been watching in Russia this year is the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, a fierce critic of President Putin. Reports have linked the Kremlin to the poisoning, a charge Putin denies. Navalny survived, but Russian authorities continue to target him. They announced new fraud accusations against him on Tuesday. As part of our end-of-year conversations, I spoke earlier with the BBC's Steve Rosenberg in Moscow, and I asked him to describe the toll beyond the numbers that the pandemic has taken on Russia in 2020.
Well, it's taken a toll on the economy. It's dealt a big blow to Russian standard of living. Again, you know, Russia's no exception here, of course. But, you know, one thing I've heard many times here over the past few months is people complaining that the scale of financial support that they've been getting from their government isn't as big as that given in other countries. Plus, you know, I've got a stack of the latest Russian newspapers here on the table, and they are full of economic doom and gloom linked to the pandemic. Even the pro-Kremlin ones, I'll give you a bit of a flavour of some of the headlines. One says, the unemployed will bankrupt the banks. And another says, the fall in real incomes, rising unemployment will spark a crisis in the banking sector. Only sausage shops will be left, says another. So I think the feeling is that because of the pandemic, you know, Russia is facing serious economic problems, which really will show up clearly in the new year.
That financial support argument sounds very familiar. We're having that same conversation here in the United States. How does that translate into the way people feel about President Putin and how he's responded to COVID-19?
If you look at the polling, President Putin's approval rating now is around 65%. Now, that is considerably down on what it was a few years back. I remember 5 years ago, it stood at 85%. But figures, numbers don't really tell you the full story of Vladimir Putin and what the Russian people think of him. We travel a lot across this massive country. Even in this pandemic year, we've managed to get around, and we speak to lots of Russians all the time. And my impression is, Tanya, that Mr. Putin's core support is far less than 65%, perhaps three times less. There's a much larger group of Russians that takes little interest in politics or politicians or the Kremlin. They just focus on their own lives, on their own everyday problems. There are Russians who would like political change. They'd like someone new running the country, but they don't really believe that they've got the power to make that happen. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got those Russians who want to take to the streets and demand political change. Not many of them. So in many ways, the Kremlin relies on the big group, the widespread apathy and indifference, really, to politics.
Let's talk a little bit about Russia's relationship with the United States. There's been so much written, said, and analyzed about President Putin and President Trump's relationship. We remember that famous press conference in Helsinki when President Trump did not confront Putin about these accusations of interference in the 2016 election. At the same time, the Trump administration continues to sanction Russia. How would you describe the Trump-Putin relationship?
Russia had very high hopes for Donald Trump. Officials in Russia hoped that Donald Trump would ride to the rescue of U.S.-Russian relations, kind of like a knight in shining armor, and make everything good again. You know, he'd scrap sanctions, mm-hmm. he'd recognize Crimea that Moscow annexed from Ukraine as part of Russia, and he'd give Putin the big glitzy summit that Putin wanted, where Trump and Putin would basically sit at the top table, you know, geopolitics, and resolve the big issues of the world like Roosevelt and Stalin after the war. Well, none of that happened. And in fact, I mean, U.S.-Russian relations plummeted. But at the same time, you know, Russia did benefit, I think, from 4 years of Donald Trump in the White House. I mean, for a start, it was nice for the Russians to have a U.S. president who didn't criticize Russia all the time, or Putin. In fact, Donald Trump often praised the Kremlin leader. Plus, I think the weakening of the Western alliance under Donald Trump, that was something viewed positively in Moscow. And that probably will come to an end, I would think, under Joe Biden.
How does the Kremlin view Joe Biden? We know that President-elect Joe Biden is now promising to punish Russia for this major cyber attack. What are they anticipating from a Biden presidency?
I think they're worried. Eventually, Vladimir Putin did congratulate Joe Biden. It took 6 weeks, but he sent him a telegram. And one of the most popular newspapers here, pro-Kremlin, announced to the Russian people that we have turned the page in U.S.-Russian relations and started afresh. But I think that is wishful thinking, because we know that Joe Biden is a vocal critic of the Kremlin. He's named Russia as the biggest threat to America. And then you have the question of personal chemistry, which is so important, isn't it, in international relations and in U.S.-Russian relations. I mean, Gorbachev and Reagan had personal chemistry, buckets of it, and they did great things together. Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin had personal chemistry. But Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, there's no sign of that. In fact, there's an interesting story that Joe Biden told a few years ago. He recounted his visit to Moscow in 2011 when he was vice president. And he was standing close to Putin, and apparently he looked Putin in the eyes and concluded that Mr. Putin had no soul and told him that. That is not the stuff, the foundation, is it, for a beautiful friendship, U.S.-Russian friendship. And then you've got these recent claims that Russia was behind the massive cyber attack on U.S. government departments and agencies. That doesn't help the relationship get off to a good start either. And one of the papers actually I've got in front of me says this about U.S.-Russian relations following news of that hack and the finger being pointed at Moscow. It says, for those experts on U.S.-Russian relations who may have been hoping for at least some improvement under Biden, the only career options left are to do themselves in, change profession, or smash their computers with a hammer. So I think there is an expectation that the relationship between Moscow and Washington is not going to improve anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. President Putin held his annual end-of-year press conference recently, and you actually asked him several questions. Let's listen to a bit of that back and forth.
Steve Rosenberg, BBC News. Господин президент, все чаще...
This was my question to President Putin. Do you think you bear any responsibility at all for the new Cold War, the current tension between East and West, considering you've been in power now for 20 years? I mean, Russia is constantly blaming external forces for the tension. I asked him whether Russia was all white and fluffy. There's a famous Russian expression, all white and fluffy, which kind of means squeaky clean. And I asked President Putin whether he thought that Russia was all white and fluffy. And he said that compared to the West, compared to you, yes, we are all white and fluffy. He said that NATO had promised not to expand to the East after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But you broke your word, he said. So I think that showed a Russian leader who bears grudges and believes that he's been deceived by the West, whether that's the case or not. He believes that various promises were made to Russia and that those promises were broken. And that he believes that he has the moral right to act in the way that he is acting.
You know, Steve, here in the United States, we've had our own questions about whether President Trump is actually going to leave the White House. Hasn't Putin basically choreographed things so that he could basically be Russia's leader for the rest of his life? We've been reporting on this throughout the year.
Well, you know, it's been a pretty bad year for Vladimir Putin in many ways, you know, the coronavirus pandemic, street protests in the Far East, all kinds of things. But one thing he's managed to pull off this year, he's managed to change the Russian constitution, or rather he choreographed it as the Russian people voting to change the constitution and bring in lots of changes, one of which is he would have the chance now, if he so desires, to run for office again and again, in fact, and stay in power potentially until 2036. That it's far too early to say whether Vladimir Putin is going to run for office again in 2024, let alone whether he's going to stay in power until 2036.
Before I let you go, Steve, I want to talk with you about something else. You're really active on Twitter at BBC Steve R. You give your followers a sense of what Russians are reading and seeing on TV and what's being sold in the papers, as you're laying out so well for us here. Something else you do on Twitter is treat us to these piano performances. And you actually recorded a piece for us that we're going to hear as we say goodbye. Tell us a little about it.
This is a very popular piece. From Soviet times, it's a famous Russian song called Snowfall by Alexei Yekimyan. This has been such a crazy year, hasn't it, for everybody? For me, music's been a way of kind of getting through this year.
Wonderful. Happy holidays. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All the best to you.
The Census Bureau says it will not meet today's deadline to report the first set of results from the 2020 count of every person living here in the U.S. Those numbers matter because they influence the amount of representation states have in Congress and the Electoral College. The delay could have political implications for President Trump and his push to exclude unauthorized immigrants from that count. And let's bring in NPR's Hansi Lo Wang to explain all of this. First, can you remind us what's behind this delay, which is one of many this year for the census?
That's right. But this delay has been expected for months, mainly because of COVID-19. Plus, the Trump administration upended the census schedule earlier this year, ultimately by cutting short the time for counting and for running quality checks on the census results. And right now, the major problem is the Census Bureau has found irregularities in the census records, and it needs more time to make sure no one is counted twice or in the wrong place, especially in a year when so many people, including college students, have moved around because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. So a check for errors, but why is there then an urgency to get these census numbers released as soon as possible? And really, how does the ending of the Trump administration next month factor into this?
Well, missing today's legal reporting deadline could throw off a series of other deadlines that are coming up for finalizing this first set of census results. But career officials at the Census Bureau also have a duty to put out accurate and complete numbers, because if they're not accurate and complete, that could result in an unfair distribution of congressional seats and Electoral College votes among the states for 10 years. And one main reason the Bureau is in this very tight spot is because the Trump administration has been pressuring the Bureau to get numbers out before Trump's term ends. That could allow the president to try to exclude unauthorized immigrants from numbers that the 14th Amendment says must include, quote, the whole number of persons in each state. The federal government has never excluded unauthorized immigrants who live in the United States from this process. But if Trump makes this unprecedented change, I'm expecting a new flurry of lawsuits in 2021.
This process can be confusing. You and your editor and the NPR visual team put out this comic strip showing how it works, which we will have on our website, hereandnow.org. What will you be thinking about in the weeks ahead in terms of what's next for the census? You kind of shared a little bit of that with us.
Yeah, I'm watching to see what happens around January 9th. That's a date, a check-in date within the Census Bureau internally that a source inside the Bureau has told me. That's when the Bureau is expected to kind of assess where things are and possibly when they may start the last steps in processing the census records. And that may be when they figure out exactly when this first set of numbers will be out and start this process for reapportioning congressional seats and ultimately Electoral College votes. So that's something to look for. And in the meantime, there is a concern that while we wait, could the Trump administration force out numbers that are inaccurate or incomplete and really throw the census process even deeper into chaos? That's another possibility in these final days of the Trump administration.
So much to watch for, and we thank you, Hansi, for all of your work in guiding us through all things census.
You're welcome, Tanya.
Locusts, protests, and COVID-19. These are just a few of the challenges Africa faced in 2020. Health experts were concerned at the beginning of the pandemic that the coronavirus would ravage the continent. But so far, other places like America and Europe are bearing the brunt. And for more on why this might be and some of the other major stories out of Africa this year, let's bring in Ader Peralta, NPR's East Africa correspondent based in Nairobi, Kenya. Hello, Ader, and Happy New Year.
Hey, Danya, Happy New Year to you.
Yes. So you said we should have known that 2020 was going to be bad because this time last year, locusts were about to descend on Kenya. You went to go see them. Let's listen.
You might be able to hear sounds they are making with their legs as they mate, which I know is pretty gross.
Ader, this was the biggest swarm seen in 70 years, and there's a lot of worry when it comes to how crops could be affected. What ended up happening?
They're still around, unfortunately, and they've eaten through hundreds of thousands of acres of land across East Africa. And, locusts, for people who are not familiar, and I really wasn't, they're just grasshoppers who are high on serotonin. And that means that they're mating like crazy, and they're also eating like crazy. And these guys, they can land on a farm one day, and by the next morning, all the crops are gone. So the swarms that are still around right now, they're not the same swarms that we saw at the beginning of the year, but the weather has just continued to be wet, and it's given them fertile environment to keep breeding. In fact, a huge swarm just moved into Kenya this week, and locust forecasters at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, they're still classifying the situation in Somalia, here in Kenya, and in Ethiopia as dangerous, and that is their most serious threat level. So the locusts will still be with us in the new year.
Wow, grasshoppers hype on serotonin. That is really interesting. Well, after these pests came the pandemic. Some epidemiologists were predicting the coronavirus could be catastrophic for the continent. But right now, the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is saying that one out of every 500 Africans has tested positive. I mean, here in the United States, it's one in 20 Americans. Now there's less testing happening there. So that may impact the numbers. But overall, what explains why Africa seems to be doing so much better than the U.S.?
Yeah, so this is a story that I just kept coming back to because the forecasts, as you mentioned, they were super bleak on the continent, and it has been bad. South Africa, is in the middle of its second wave right now. They've had more than 1 million cases and almost 300,000 deaths. But compared to the West, we're not doing bad here. Here in Kenya, there have been fewer than 2,000 deaths, and the why of that is really complicated. Scientists, they're still trying to figure this out. And What we have now are theories. One of the big ones is that this is the youngest continent in the world. So the average age in many countries is in the teens. And as we know, young people deal with COVID-19 much better than older people. Another thing, though, is that governments here have, by and large, followed the science. They locked down early, they mandated masks almost immediately when this pandemic started. And let me just give you an example of what it's like to travel around the continent. Before I leave to pretty much any African country, I have to take a PCR COVID test. I have to be negative before getting on the plane. And before I get here to Kenya, for example, I have to fill out a contact tracing form online. And every day for 14 days, I get a text message asking me if I've developed any symptoms. Other countries like Nigeria, they're requiring a 14-day quarantine. And scientists, they don't really know what kind of effect these policies have had, but they believe that they have likely helped to flatten the curve here in many countries.
Wow, I know that we'll be following that for quite some time. This year will also be remembered for its protests. In China, there was Hong Kong. In the U.S., there was George Floyd. And in Nigeria, there was SARS, or the Special Anti-Robbery Squad. Eyewitnesses say Nigerian forces opened fire. Around a dozen protesters were killed. Remind us briefly what happened in October.
It was very similar to what we have seen happen in the U.S. A video of a brutal police shooting went viral, and it sent Nigerians to the streets. And at first, they were protesting against this special unit, SARS, which you mentioned, and how they treated civilians and how they extorted them for money. Suddenly, the demands grew and the protests went nationwide. They started becoming about young people asking for a better life and a better government. They became the biggest anti-government protests in decades in Nigeria. And they culminated with this huge sit-in at an iconic bridge in Lagos. Thousands of mostly young people, they camped out there, they danced, they sang. But protesters, for now, have gone home. There was this kid that they used to call Flag Boy, who he became kind of the icon of this protest movement because he always carried this huge Nigerian flag. And a few weeks ago, he went out on the streets again. He's alone. He has nobody else with him. But I spoke to him recently, and he told me that as long as the flag is still flying, there is still hope for change in Nigeria.
Oh, wow. Meanwhile, Ethiopia is spiraling back into civil war, it looks like. And you actually went to Sudan to speak with some refugees about this violence.
Yeah, so getting into Ethiopia has been really hard. So I went just on the border where about 60,000 Ethiopians have fled into Sudan. And I spoke to Letekido Sabadi, who, you know, told us this wrenching story about what had happened at home.
I saw forces killing. Some people are killing and they're beaten by knife.
And as you can hear that interpreter saying there, Ethiopian forces attacked her town with machetes and knives, killing hundreds. This is especially tragic given the fact that the Ethiopian prime minister was just awarded the Nobel Peace Prize last year. What explains this?
So it's complicated. I mean, look, this is a conflict. It's a power struggle. It's between Ethiopia's old government and its new one. And, you know, one of the things that I found at these camps is that everything, you know, that caused this war is there. The ethnic tensions are there. The politics are there. But what I found overwhelming was this feeling of loss. And everyone there had lost something, you know, whether it was a child or a mom or a dad or a brother or just a business that they had spent decades making. So these camps, they were just full of sadness. And one of the tragedies here is that not very long ago, Ethiopians were full of hope that things were going to be different from now on in this country. Mm. One of the big promises that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed made when he came to power is that differences in Ethiopia would be settled by talking, by negotiating, not through violence, as, you know, has been the case for centuries in Ethiopia. And at those refugee camps, you know, all of that hope felt really far away. It felt distant.
Yeah. One ray of hope to end our conversation, Ader, in Kenya, where you're based. There's been a baby boom of elephants, 170 born this year. What's the reason?
So it's rains, good rains for many years before. But not only that, this is the first time in recorded history, in the recorded history of that park, of Amboseli National Park, where they've had two pairs of twins born in a year. I was lucky enough to catch them. And I don't know if you've ever seen baby elephants, but they're so cute.
Never in person. That had to be a treat.
They're amazing. They bumble. They're like big toddlers. But procreation is also really hard for elephants. They have a 22-month gestation period, and the females only go into estrus when the conditions are just right. So this is really a great moment for the park and for Kenya, and the twins, I'm happy to report, are doing really great.
Well, thank you for sharing that good news for us as we go into 2020. Ada Peralta is NPR's East Africa correspondent. As always, thank you for your work.
Thank you, Tanya.
And some other joy we want to share comes from South Africa, with music from Bangadziwe Mabanla. On this New Year's Eve, we're looking back at 2020 and some of the people that made an impact this year, like 15-year-old Gitanjali Rao of Colorado. Time magazine named her Kid of the Year in recognition of her commitment to creating scientific solutions, including a tool that detects lead in water. We spoke with Gitanjali Rao earlier this month and started by congratulating her.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Yes, Gitanjali, I want to know more about how your love of science and innovation came to be. We're reading when you were 10 years old, you created this tool to detect lead in water after learning about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. What drives you?
To this day, I can't really say that there was one aha moment when everything came together. But instead of that, it was almost like this learning and growing experience for me of combining my love of science and technology with putting a smile on someone's face. And now I basically use science for kindness every day. And that's really my goal, is to innovate for the better, innovate to make positive change in this world. And that's what makes me keep going. And that's what drives me, knowing that people out there do need help. And I'm willing to kind of take what I know and put that out there for other people to use.
Innovate for the better. You've created a host of other tools too, including one for cyberbullying and opioid addiction. Can you tell me a little bit about these projects and how those came about?
Absolutely. So my opioid addiction tool is called Epione, and it helps to diagnose prescription opioid addiction at an early stage using the latest developments in protein detection methods. So you basically put in a sample of bodily fluid, and you're able to receive your results on a mobile app in a user-friendly skill, along with action items, including a map of the nearest addiction centers. The idea from this really came from just a family friend who ended up getting into a car accident and becoming addicted to opioids. And by the time he knew about it, it was too late to do anything about it. And this was a constant problem that I saw all over the news, and I'm still seeing all over the news. And if no one else was going to solve it, then I needed to take the first steps. Similarly, with Kindly, which is my service to detect and prevent cyberbullying, it's based on developments in artificial intelligence and machine learning, and is able to identify and point out any words or phrases that might be considered bullying. So I really wanted to find a way to help stop cyberbullying, because I wanted to create a safer place for teenagers to talk to each other.
I am really hearing in you this passion for finding solutions. You know, this year we've all been watching the work of scientists racing to create a vaccine for COVID-19. I'm just thinking about the way you think. You have had to think about how you would contribute to this effort.
I have. Yes, I totally have. So first of all, just like you said, a huge thank you to all the healthcare workers, researchers, and scientists for developing a vaccine in 9 months, which before this we never thought was possible. So those technological strides is what is the silver lining on this cloud. But if I look deeper into my contribution, I really want to look at some sort of data and predictive analytics approach for prioritization and distribution of these vaccines, just to make it more effective and efficient. So that might be something I'm working on in the next couple of months. But along with that, I also want to find ways to prevent more pandemics from in the future, just to make sure we don't have another crisis like COVID again. And I think the reason for this is because zoonotic diseases and cross-species transmission is going to become way more frequent in these next couple of years. So it's best to stop it now rather than having to go through it and then trying to find another way to stop it.
What are you into, though, when you're not working to save the world? Did I hear that you're actually working on your pilot's license?
I am, yes. I'm working on my pilot's license right now, and it is super fun. I can't drive a car, but I can fly a plane, which I think is
super exciting. Isn't that something?
Yeah, oh yeah. It's so cool. I feel like flying is easier, too.
What advice would you have for other budding innovators out there, especially in this moment that we're in?
So for other innovators out there, I would say dream big and then think back to reality. Because I'm quite literally living in a dream. These are things I never thought I would actually do, but here I am today accomplishing them. So dream big, come up with ideas, have fun with it, and then look at how you can do it. Because there's no one stopping you but yourself.
That's Gitanjali Rao, Time Magazine's first ever Kid of the Year. Congratulations. And hey, can I have your parents' phone number? I got to learn how to create a human like you.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And from all of us at Here and Now, we want to wish you a happy New Year's Eve. We know the celebrations tonight won't be quite as grand as other years, but as we look back on the year and try to make sense of our tremendous losses, we're celebrating all the moments that we came together as people to help one another, to find solutions, and to find joy wherever possible. Here's to a brighter 2021. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.